We're on the air. Let's see how the broadcast gets from the studio to your home.
I just want to hear the music, that's all.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B. I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you?
What does it all mean?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Yes!
Sounds Visual is a podcast featuring interviews and long-form conversations with DJs, crate diggers, record collectors, vinyl enthusiasts, beat makers, producers, and musicians. All right, it's time for another episode of Sounds Visual Radio. My name is Justin. Thanks for tuning in. Today, my guest on the podcast is Tim Rust, who sells records under the name Gratitude Records and has a simple philosophy: hustle, grind, and repeat. Tim is constantly on the move, driving all over the Pacific Northwest, buying record collections, aiming to keep his inventory fresh and his clientele happy. He stopped by to talk to us about how he learned the business of buying and selling records, first starting small at 360 Vinyl, and eventually expanding his consignment into several locations all over Portland. Tim also opened up about why he's been buying country records more lately, what the most expensive LP he ever bought was, and how sobriety recalibrated his priorities. If you want to drop us a line here at the podcast, our email is soundsvisualradio@gmail.com. And you can always find archived episodes of the show at mixcloud.com/soundsvisualradio. All right, let's talk to Tim Rust of Gratitude Records.
Born in Southeast Portland, lived here my whole life. I went to Our Lady of Sorrows grade school and Central Catholic High School and graduated from Portland State University. I've lived in Ashland, Oregon. I've lived in Spokane, Washington. I played football up there for a few years in college, which is a cool town. I lived in Hawaii for a while in my early marriage and then came back, but no.
Where in Hawaii did you live?
Oahu.
Oh, okay.
You know, my father-in-law sold a bunch of real estate, then he started a business, and he wanted me to go work with him, but it was at the end of my marriage, and it was kind of one of those things where it was a Hail Mary pass, and it just kind of wasn't, it didn't feel right, you know, like it wasn't, my wife wanted to be with her dad, Hawaii's cool. It's just kind of an island, you know, so you're kind of there, and I like Portland's weather. I like gray. I don't mind sun, but I'm more productive when it's not sunny. I tend to kind of head for the shadows, you know what I mean? Like, I got a lot of body hair, so I get a little hot, but it was cool.
How long were you in Hawaii?
It's like a year deal.
Oh, okay.
You know, but it was one of those things where we had a house and it was sell the house and move to Hawaii to make it work. And I didn't feel comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see the business failed, and I could kind of, having watched my dad run a small business, like my spidey sense was like, this shit's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he wants to play tennis all the time. So it's just like, you got to work. If you want to do a business, you got to work twice as hard, not half as much.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's the bottom line, you know?
Yeah. And then you came back to Portland from Hawaii?
I came back to Portland, remodeled my house. My wife stayed there with the boys, which was cool. You know, it was cool for her. She kind of got to do that. And then she came home and it was just kind of like, you know, we're going to get divorced.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, that's the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
When I was going to Portland State, I had a rate. That's when I started to DJ.
Okay.
You know? So I got done playing college football and kind of was looking for an identity, you know, because I was like, all right, I used to be a college football player. Now that's done.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what am I now? You know, and I always liked music, and I had, you know, hundreds, thousands of CDs, and I was just like, I'll be a DJ, you know?
So, and what kind of music were you?
Rap, you know?
You were, like, okay.
I was into rap, but, you know, so like my first gig, I had CDJs, you know, and my first DJ gig was at this bar called The Hutch on like Gleason, mm-hmm. you know, and it was like one of my friends from high school, sister was the manager, and I go in there with all this rap
gear.
Shit, and I set up my DJ set up, and I was facing the wall, you know, like, and I was just like, I was, you know, like, it was just like the first one, I was like, oh, yeah, cool. Not the best idea.
Yeah.
And just played to all these people who had no desire to be DJ'd to, you know, like it was like, it was a bar, a tavern. So I was just playing all, you know, I had like all my stuff pre-made, which ones were going to go into which ones, you know, and it just went to shit in a hurry because nobody wanted to hear rap. Nobody, everyone there, I mean, I figured it out and it was cool. Like, I was like, no. And then I turned into a classic rock DJ fast. You know, I was like, this is what's going to work here. Like, this is what they want to hear, you know, and I kind of, it's kind of how I've changed, you know, try to just adapt to the situation, you know what I mean? Because it was like, this is a gig that I have. Even though I was still passionate about it, it was like just figuring it out, you know?
How old were you when you started getting into hip hop and rap? Did it start young for you?
Or? Oh, yeah. I mean, like tapes, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, like sixth grade. Oh,
okay.
You know, was into rap. Like, whatever, my brother, I think he had like the Boogie Down production tape where he was holding the gun, you know, like the Malcolm X picture, and I thought that looked really cool. I don't really remember liking the music per se, but I remember it just being
the image.
Like, this is cool.
Yeah,
you know, like this, I was drawn to that. My sister, but it was like Big Daddy Kane, stuff mm-hmm. like that was what I was into. The Beastie Boys, of course, was mm-hmm. like a big like thing to me. My brother liked them, so I liked them. You know, like I got older brothers and sisters, so
mm-hmm.
I kind of listened to their stuff, Salt and Peppa, stuff like that. You know, just that was when I got into rap. Very soon, I fucking punted the CDJs and got turntables. I was like, this isn't what I want, you know, like, because I was buying all these CDs and I had all these CDs and I still would kind of rock them, but I bought record players within the first like month after that.
Okay.
Like, this is better. These are made more sense to get the kind of stuff I thought I wanted, you know, like,
yeah.
Was like, oh, I get this Journey record for $1, you know, like, whatever. What were those 210s?
Mm-hmm.
360, 420 price tags at Everyday Music, you know? So it was just like, those were the prices back in the day, 50 cent green labels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, buying collections is when it was just like, oh, that's the way to get records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I can find some cool old musician who's got a shit ton of records and fast forward, like, the process, kind of, sort of, you know? And so that's what really got me into selling records, actually, and just kind of getting them, you know. It's like biting off more than I could chew, and like, you know, but it was for DJing purposes. It was fun, you know, like I DJed a lot at the Delta Cafe, mm-hmm. you know, but I was mostly like a mobile jockey where I would drag all of my stuff. I'd find a lot like what I do now with my business is like find a good space and be like, it would be better if this was with it, you know, mm-hmm. the records would go good in here, or the DJ. So I'd drag, had a whole gear set up and, you know, and set it up, take it down. So, but yeah, no, I didn't start selling. I started selling. I bought this guy Paige Baker's record collection. I had a friend of mine who owned this bookstore. His name was Philip. And then he had this friend named Paige, and he went to read, and Paige went to read with him. And Philip was just like, I got this guy Paige. He needs money for a wedding ring, and he wants to store his records at my bookstore, and I do not want these records, so I'll put you two together, you know. And I met Paige, and he just had this killer record collection. He'd worked at Music Millennium, was like a jazz vocalist. He had just cool stuff. I mean, and it was like he needed $2,000, you know, and I did not have $2,000 at the mm-hmm. time. I was just like, wife was not feeling it, so gave him $2,000 for it, because it was just killer, you know. There's just all these cool records that were really cool. He had good stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have a clue 8 out of 10 records, I didn't know what they were. You know what I mean? I was like, blues? Who wants that? You know, like, right. Oh, who wants that? You know, so I was focused on rhythm, jazz, and blue, you know, like funk, mm-hmm. you know. And he had a little bit of that, but he had a ton of classical, because he was kind of a classical singer. But so I started selling at Crossroads then to kind of, but I was doing it all wrong. You know, I was just selling all the records that I wanted versus the ones that I didn't want.
Right.
You know? I was like, because who would want those? Because I don't want them. You know what I mean? So I just didn't sell those. I just sold the ones I wanted. It was kind of not the smartest move, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but totally wrong, you know, like would kind of wholesale some of them when I needed cash. So I remember I going into Sonic Recollections and bring, because they were super clean and everything, and selling them. And he did what I do now, you know, like $2-3 a piece. I'd go in there a week later and there's one on the wall for $200. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just like, what am I doing? Yeah. I had no clue like what I was doing. I mean, not all of them, but just,
yeah, sure.
Like, do you have any more records? Bring more in. You know, I was like, oh, I don't think I'm going to do that anymore. Yeah. I just didn't know how to value records. Like, I remember asking Kit, and he kind of taught me his little triangulation method. And I was like, okay, this is data, you know, like we're trying to figure out. But I just didn't know a lot of the stuff. I just didn't know what they were. I know I liked them. So, yeah, it was cool. It didn't go very well. You know, I didn't want to let go. You know, I was the classic. I didn't have a clue what I was selling. And maybe it went well. I didn't want to do more of it. I didn't mm-hmm. know how to source more. I only had this one pile, mm-hmm. you know, and when it would get uncomfortable, then I'd dump more and make up prices, really. Like, mm-hmm. I remember just Tom being like, bring some more records in. I was like, what did I fucking miss? Kind of sort of being like, and so I was leery because I could tell I didn't know what I was doing. So I was like, this, you know, and so.
So when did you make the move into doing that full time? Like what
so
was the...
So post-divorce, you know, like I ripped and ran for a year, you know, took a bunch of money out of my house. Then we got divorced, ended up in rehab, you know, and I remember sitting in rehab and my counselor, Tim, was just like, so you don't have a house, you don't pay any child support with your kids, but you're so worried about these records. I kept talking about my records and how, you know, because I was just, like a lot of people, and you get kind of torn, you get torn out of your everyday life, and you're like, oh, what about this? You know, and I was paying storage on these records. Like, I was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to pay storage for my thing. How am I going to, you know, because I was, you know, whatever. I was worried mm-hmm. about losing my possessions, you know? Mm-hmm. And he just kind of broke it down, and he kind of, I'm friends with him now afterwards, you know, 10 years later. I don't think it wasn't like intentional. It was just kind of an off the cuff thing, you know, but it like stuck with me. It was just like, you're right. Like, these things are more of a priority to me than those things, you know? And so, got out of rehab. My friend let me live. He was my friend's a developer. So he had bought all this property, and it was right now, it was like 2007. So all of the economy was going crazy. So he would buy something, tear it down, and put up 4 things. Right. So we had this house. And he let me move into the house, and I started, you know, Brian Gilbert, mm-hmm. do you know Brian Gilbert? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had become friends with him, and he was selling records at 360 Vinyl, and he's like, oh, you should sell records at 360 Vinyl, and that's when I started doing it. You know, I'd had failed attempts, but I just wouldn't let go, but it was like, it was make or break time for me at that point. It was like, I didn't have a job, I needed to make some money, I had started having good success, you know, like I kind of put a lot of effort into the records. I used to type up descriptions of the mm-hmm. breaks on all the records.
I remember
the typewriter,
that,
you know,
yeah.
And I was real passionate about that, you know. So, you know, I was given more than I was getting. So it was kind of a recipe for success, you know what I mean? So where I was real passionate about it. Aaron was really focused on, Brian was flipping breaks, you know, like down there. We would write the breaks on them and teach people about the breaks, you know, and there was this website called thebreaks.com mm-hmm. before, like, Who Sampled, and it was kind of not as known as, you know what I mean? It wasn't as fluid. It wouldn't pop up on a...
Yeah, they didn't have an app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just, if you knew about it, you knew about it. Oh, so that, yeah, so when I was going to Portland State, I was going to the Portland State Business School, and I printed out the entire website of thebreaks.com. Yeah, the whole website. I had it on double-sided in the School of Business in these big binders.
Wow.
And I would carry it around with me.
That's amazing.
And I'd go to, like, there was this guy at the beach. I don't know if you ever heard of him. His name was, like, Richard Moore. He had this huge warehouse of records, like, in Gearhart. Like, huge. Like,
yeah.
Yeah,
and it just was chilling, like they
just
were
just chilling. Yeah. Just he'd stand out on the side of the road. He's an old Vietnam vet. He was like standing on the side of the road. He loved Elvis, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he just had all these records. Like, it was crazy. It had to be 50,000 records.
Yeah,
I mean, and 45s too. And it was like alphabetized, whatever. And it's just this goofy guy. And he's like, it was like $1 or $2 a piece. You know, like didn't matter what it was. And it was just. And I remember just going through it, and I found a couple cool things. So I would take those binders down there and just start, and I wouldn't talk about it. And like, there was other people who kind of knew about it. But I remember being there and like, I was getting into disco or 12 inches and he had probably 1,000 12 inch singles or more.
Wow.
And he would be like, those are only a quarter because there's only one song on them. And I was like, I'll buy them all.
Yeah.
So I literally
bought
like $200 or $300 worth of 12 inches and then had this huge 12 inch collection. The 45s are way cheaper. I remember I gave him $300 for three. He would let me pick 3,000 45s out of his 45s. So I would fill my Suburban full of these banana boxes banana boxes full of 45s, just looking for funk songs. And he would let me just run them. But
wow.
He was crazy.
Like, yeah.
He is crazy. He's a peer or a mentor, you know, like Richard Moore is cool. Yeah, I kept thinking when I first found it, I was like, he's going to hit me in the head with a shovel, take my ID,
go home
to my house, and get all my... This is like his spider web.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like, and I just would be like...
It's like a horror movie. Yeah. A metal horror movie.
I was just like, why? How is he doing this? Mm-hmm. How is this? And he'd always be tempting you with, like, there's more, and there would always be more. Like, I would pull, like, that... those, like, dance moves, Luigi thing or whatever, you know, that record, like, pull that out. I'm like, what is this doing here? How do you have this? And all this other stuff. Like,
and what did he say? He just had it? I mean,
I didn't ask him like that, but he was just like, I mean, incredible stuff that has come out of there. Like, and a lot, but I didn't know what I was looking for again. But when I had the books, I was like, oh, cool. It's like, you know, 10cc has breaks, so I just go there and just buy all the 10cc records. Or I was like, this has this, and so I would just start, you know, and then that kind of helped me figure it out. But those books kind of helped me figure out what kind of bands had breaks.
Yeah. Kind of dipped your toe into basically doing it full time now that you're 360.
It couldn't have been full time. Aaron didn't have that big of a store,
right?
And he would only kind of let you have this much,
yeah,
right. And then so I convinced him to kind of, well, I didn't convince him, but it convinced itself. Like you shouldn't have house records. He invested a lot of money to buy 360 from the previous owner, so and he bought those records. So he was like, I'm going to sell these records. You know, these are my. And I get it. And it changed. So, but no, I'd be like, I used to be like, yo, you need classic rock records in here. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, I know. Like four out of every, or three people who walk in here, walk over there and walk right out. I'm like, let's put them in there then, you know? And that's the deal. You know, I got on that early. I was like, that's what I'm finding. Like around Portland, when I buy these collections, it's just like, that was kind of, So at that point I was mostly buying and selling funk records. You know, that's what I was passionate about. You know, but it wasn't sustainable with just selling funk records. Cause one, there's no funk records in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's just no black people, or there haven't been a lot of black people in Portland. And so those records aren't here, like aren't naturally here. So it works. So 360 was working. It would be a check, you know, but I remember like grossing, not netting, like grossing 500 was a big deal. But how do you live off that? You
know what I
mean? And you're buying records. It's just like not. But yeah, but that wasn't it. It was like you'd make a couple hundred bucks. It was cool. But
sure.
it helped me figure it out. Like when I started figuring out low end records and like asking him to put records on the floor. So we do $3 records on the floor, and then that would, you know, bolster the number. And then when he did the rock, that would bolster the number. So we got it into four figures eventually, but it took a while. It took a while, you know, like, from there I went to Crossroads, you know, and got, I think I had a table or two tables, but eventually I got it up to like 14 tables. You know, and, you know, just filling, it was like this upside down triangle, you know, and I figured out how to turn the triangle the other way to where I was like buying all this stuff, but I didn't have anywhere to sell it. You know what I mean? So I'd buy all this records and all these records, but it was only so much here. And, but then just buying huge collections kind of changed everything. Post divorce, I learned about Craigslist, and then I started like, it was just easier to buy them all, you know, like I would try to pick, but I was just like, I'll just take them all. And it was always, you know, that. So, you know, I reference everything around my sobriety. So I know like my first sobriety date. So like 2009.
Your baseline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's what changed everything. You know, like when I was smoking pot every day, it just being an addict, it just wasn't good for me to be ambitious. You know, like I'd have these ideas, but I wouldn't follow through with it. Post that, it's like, oh, I can do this, you know? So, you know, 9, 10. So I was living in that house that my friend was letting me buy or live in. And I walked up to this estate sale, like 4 blocks from my house, you know? And I was like, do you have any records? And they all kind of looked at each other and they're like, yeah, come in. And so he was a grandmaster chess champion.
Oh, wow.
And he had like five, his whole basement was just full of records. Cool guy. I mean, he was dead, but I didn't know, but he had, you know, killer VPI, killer hi-fi setup, like a killer, like virtual chess table that he would play people all over the world in, you know?
Oh, wow.
It was cool. Like, but a super bachelor pad. And I was just like, so it was a lot of like lame records, but he had like 1500 audiophile records. Mm. Like he collected them all. He had the whole run of Half Speed Masters. He had the whole run of Sheffield. He had the whole run of everything, pretty much. Like he ran it, and those are super valuable, you know? And she was like, I need $5,000, and I didn't have $5,000, but I had an Airstream at the time, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll sell my Airstream for this. But I offered her $4,000. I was like, I think this is worth $4,000, because I didn't have a distribution channel for the records. Like, I didn't know how I was going to sell these. But there was other killer records in there. Like, he like a lot of big record collections. There's cool stuff, you know, but super all minty. Everything was perfect. So that was in the summertime. I asked Brian Gilbert for a loan, and he was like, yeah, I'll loan it to you. We'll go in together. And I was like, okay, cool. Because he knew how to sell records on eBay. But she didn't take it. She's like, nope, not enough. And then so I walk out of there, and I see Tom Jones from Crossroads, like, walking in and out. Because she was like, I'm going to call people on Hawthorne about this collection, you know? And so I talked to Tom, and he made an offer, and I had just offered her $4,000, and I was like, whoa, what'd you offer her? And he's like, $1,200. I was just like, whoa, way off, right? I'm just way fucking off. Like, it's just like, and so I just had all this weight just got lifted off my shoulders.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, cool. You know? So Thanksgiving comes. There's these two twin gals who are the nieces of the guy, and they call me and I'm like, you are the nicest guy. We just sold the house. We got to get all these records out of here. They didn't say, you know, like, and so she's like, well, where did they take your offer? And I was like, well, I don't have $4,000 anymore. I have $1,200 or 13 or 14 or whatever it was $1,200. I was like, I have $1,200. And there's this long pause. And then she's like, but I was like, also I will, I'll come over with my, I worked for my dad who has a construction company. I was like, I'll come over with my dump truck and I will empty your house of all the stuff that you don't want. And it was all goodwill. Like, he had nice stuff. So it was just like literally just loading it in this. But they were like, nobody lived in Portland. And they were like, okay. And I was like, cool. Because I wanted to, like, everything. Like, the secret of success is like doing extra and being happy about it, you know? So it was like, here's the deal. I'll give you labor, you know? So I brought 4 guys over there to move this collection. And we also moved all the stuff. Bought that collection. And then my wife, and was able to quit my job, you know, because I made probably $40,000 or $50,000 off that collection just because of the audiophile stuff, and learned how to sell on eBay and started my eBay kind of thing. got a role together, you know, investing yeah. into it. And so was able to buy a lot more stuff, have enough guts to kind of expand at Crossroads. So Crossroads, I would just start grabbing any piece. I ended up getting 10 tables at Old Crossroads, which is a lot of space at Old Crossroads. Dave, the owner, and so kind of convinced him to kind of shuffle all of my tables together back into that corner where I had all the yellow tables by the bathroom. And that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. That was like, it made money, you know, mm-hmm. like, because it was like the best record store in Portland. And a lot of the dealers there just weren't about organization, you know, like it was like this old digging kind of thing, you know. It's like, oh, you know. They want to dig. And I was just like, I remember seeing like Randy RCF, who had like A through Z rock. I was like, I'm doing that with everything, you know, because if I have a Curtis Mayfield record, I want you to find it. And that was the big bet. New Crossroads is different. A lot of people have got hip to that, and it's a lot much more organized space, you know. Mm-hmm. just changed.
So the stores that you're servicing now still are Crossroads, still obviously
Crossroads. Bar I have Carlo. A record store in Bar Carlo,
right?
I work with Future Shock, and then I'm in this barber shop over here called Taylor Blade. It's cool. I dig it. Clothes, records, yeah, and just trying to keep, you know, the consignment thing going. Crazy. It's what it is.
Now, when you buy collections, do you typically, you don't piecemeal? You just say, I'll give you an X amount for the whole thing.
2 days ago, I looked at this, that last picture I have on Instagram where I'm just by the huge. Mm-hmm. Those are all like country records. And those are all like folk. It's just like 15,000, 20,000 like bad wow. records.
Yeah.
But in it,
right.
in it, I found like that Lee Moses record uh-huh. was in it.
I saw that, yeah.
And so like, what is this doing here? Like he would buy anything that was looky country. So there's a lot of cool like folk psych uh-huh. and psych records and whatever. But so that one, I'll make an offer on it. And I made an offer. And then, so I'll find out, but that one I would have loved to have just picked, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? But he's just like, you got to buy it all. Mm. So ideally I want to pick it. It depends. Like when I used to do this thing called the record rig, you mm-hmm. know, like, and so, and it was just a way to deal with the excess, you know. I only wanted 200 of these 500. What do I do with these 300 records? Right. Mm-hmm. And it's just like sell them for less than they're worth and it'll be cool. And it worked. And like, that's with Future Shock. I was like, yo, you got to have this big $2 section. He's like, what? I'm like, people want to buy something less than it's worth. Mm-hmm. It works and it'll get people in the door and it greases the wheel. And I'm buying 1,000 records a week. I got to dump this.
Got to go somewhere.
Know? And people, there's a million people trying to hustle records. And so they're, you know, those like dealers are buying it, but also like civilians are buying it. Mm-hmm. And it's just this nice thing that mm-hmm. works, you know? Mm-hmm. So when it's good, it's great. So like something like that, it's like, he's got 15,000 records. I want, I'll try to get it for $1,000. That one, you know, like, there'll probably be 300 or 400 records that I would try to get. And mm-hmm. then the rest just go like Kit. I bought Kit's big collection. He had like two collections. And when I started vintage with that, I was just like, it's X amount of dollars, you know? And it's just like, I can triple my money. And when these 100, with this 1,000 of these 6,000, but these 5,000, $2. And people love it. And the universe is just like, this is a good thing. It's a lot of work to be that way. But like the most successful I've been is when I was the most generous with the stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and just being like, God's not going to give me any more if my hands are full.
Yeah, let's jump into some records then.
This record, when I was DJing, like started DJing, you know, like, and it's clear, intimate connection, you know, like when I started DJing, or I don't know if I had started DJing yet, but I'd come back from college and I was going to Portland State and I was going out to nightclubs all the time, you know, and I remember I'd go to this, it's called Jezebel's, you know, you remember Jezebel's? Mm-hmm. It was like on Division or off Hawthorne. And like Wicked Wednesdays was there on Wednesdays, and there's this guy, I forget Thursdays, but on Tuesday nights with this guy named Fremont Slim, like Scott Hamilton. He's awesome, right? And he worked at Everyday Music with Grover, and like I just see him all over the place, you know? So then he started DJing this bar downtown. It was like Betty Ford's, but it was like before this Betty Ford's. It was like this, had like a, Ryan wouldn't remember the name, but it was like this, it had like a tiki vibe thing. It was like a tiki room thing, right? And there was this, yeah, like a Pirates, and I'm in there and I'm listening to the song, and this song's playing, right? That I know. It's like DJ Quick Tonight.
Here we go, here we go.
And I'm listening to this, and then he blends it into fucking Clear Tonight, right? And I didn't know about samples like that at that time, you know, and my mind just fucking blew up. So I'm like, waited till the end of the night, and I go up to fucking Scott. I'm like, what did you do that? And he just points back to Ryan, and Rev Shines was back there, like, and he was handing Scott records to play, you know, back in the day. It was like before Ryan was like DJing, you know, like he was working at Jump, I'm sure around then or sometime, but and he's like, that guy knows, you know? And I was like, what's that guy? You know? Like,
yeah.
And so I just started like, what is that? And he's just like, oh, it's just record Clear. It's got a phone on the cover. You know, it's like, it's Clear with three E's. That's what I wanted to find.
You
know? Like, and so it blew my mind. Archie Whitewater, remember like Mike Samples, you know, Mike Samples, mm-hmm. Like he, for some reason, could come up with more of these records. I was just like, and it was about the sourcing things. Like, how does Mike Samples?
Yeah. How does he?
Right. That's the wonderful there. He's tight lipped. So this was, I think, the first time I'd spent $100 on a record.
Yeah.
And it just was like, it was a cool mix of like folk and or psych and like, you know, there's two good songs on it. It's good. You know, so, but no, mostly just like, yeah, I spent money on it, but mostly like, how does Mike Samples find his records? Now a lot more is like, you know Billy Joe Shaver. So he's like, you know, he's mid 70s, awesome songs, singer songwriter, does his own thing, doesn't play any instruments because he's missing that finger right there, but he wrote every song on this record, which this is kind of like the beginning of outlaw country. Mm-hmm. Like this is the seminal one of whatever, Waylon Jennings, Honky Tonk Heroes. And he wrote all the songs on it. This is what I, you know, going from funk, which is still cool. I can lean into that. But like country and outlaw country, like my grandpa kind of migrated from South Dakota to Portland, you know, in the whenever, 40s, which is cool. And I've gone back there and I can relate to country, you know, like I'm a kind of a blue collar guy. So but I definitely romanticize about funk and jazz, but kind of never got into country.
Mm-hmm.
Bought like 8,000 country records last 2 years ago and this whole guy's garage. And I was like, so I had it all, essentially, not at all, but it's like, and I have a considerable pile of country now just, and it's, I like it. It's like rap. It is. It has the same kind of storytelling of rap. I mean, now you see with this new Lil Nas song that's like the most hottest song, like country and rap are very similar genres, I think. Mm-hmm. Like this, the way they tell stories, the songs always rhyme, it has a chorus, it's like the vocal part is very much, it's like, you know, like well, used to be, you know, like not necessarily glamoury. Glamour rap sucks, right? But the good stuff's good, and like outlaw is good. I don't know. It's fun.
I spent a lifetime making up my mind to be more than the measure of what I thought others could see. Good luck and fast bucks are too far and too few between.
Let's see, most expensive record I ever bought.
Let's hear it.
I had gone to St. Louis one year. I was in St. Louis to look for records. So I go there, Kit was going to go there. And so I was like, I was talking to Kit. He's like, I'm going to visit my brother. And I was just like, I'm going to go, you know? So I didn't stay with him or do whatever, but he was the reason why, how I went to the, you know? And so I go, God, what is that? It's a pink sticker. Anyways, I go into this record store in St. Louis, right? And I'm like, I'm there to buy. So I'm like super low budget, like low overhead, right? Mm-hmm. I got a car, but whatever. So I go into this record store, House of Records maybe it is, and I start working in, and I'm like, okay, I'll go through those cheap records fast or last, you know? So I work my way around the end, and I see them all just start taking all the cheap records out. And I'm like, what's going on with that? So then they start putting new stuff in. So I'm like the first guy into this new stuff. I get into it, and every record is sealed. It's all funk and soul records from the 60s and 70s, perfectly sealed. And they're all like $3, $5, $8, right?
Wow.
And I'm like Ruby Andrews,
what?
Like just like sealed, right?
Black Ruby?
Yeah.
Get out of town,
Casanova,
dude.
Casanova on it, that one.
Never seen that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, seal. I sold it to Whoever Shines.
Oh, my God.
That copy. But like... what else was in that record collection? Or it wasn't a collection, but it was just like, you know, so like Johnny Hammond Gears sealed, everything's sealed. And I, you know, so I bought $1,000 worth of records that day. Right. It was just like killer stuff. So I take it to I go up to the deal and then they let me go in the back. They're like, oh, we have a bunch more. And they're like, this record store closed in 1981 in Ohio. And we just bought the granddaughter.
I was going to say, where did it all come from?
It's all dead stock from like a record store that closed in the 80s. And they were just blowing it out, right? And so I'm at this record show. And this guy, number two in command at Funk U, because Funk U's in St. Louis, finds me at this record show. And he's like, some short guy from Oregon got in there and bought them all first, you know? And I'm just like, that's me.
That's me.
You know? And he's just like, let me see him.
Snooze you lose.
I want some for my personal collection. And I called Kit, and Kit went over there and got some. Like, he got some gospel ones. But I think I had a smartphone, and I was working it, you know? Like, it was... Yeah, like Impressions records, but look, the one with the calendar, and it's like sealed, which is just cool because it's never in there, you know. Like, what else was in that? Killer records. So I had found all these, and then I went to the Eugene record show, and it just rained. It was just like, you know, like I had a line at my table because I had like 400.
I'll
and
bet.
Then on top of what I work, you know what I mean? Because I still, and I went there and worked and found good records at the show.
Yeah.
So I had all, I was like cash rich, you know. I was just like, I'm going to buy something. Yeah. I was just like, how do I, you know, and I was at this time where it was, you know, like, the reinvestment. So I was just like, okay, I'm going to go find the best record I can find, you know. So this dude, Tony from Everyday Music, he kind of looks like Napoleon Dynamite, you know. He was just like, oh, I found this at Everyday Music. And he sold it to me. And I was like, I guess, and everyone was like freaking out over it. Like, oh, this is on the ground there. Everybody wants this. You know, like it's cool. Like, have you know this record?
I do know it. I mean, I don't have it.
This is Thrust by McNeil and Niles. It's weird. Everyone was freaking out over it. I didn't know what it was. I did a Google search. I was like, I guess that's the one. You know, like, people like Thrust by McNeil and Niles.
Yep.
So that was...
Summer Fun. Yeah, I've seen the reissue of this, but I've never seen the original.
It looks different.
Yeah, right? The cover's different.
Yeah, it's that stock kind of thing, which is cool. I'm grateful when reissues look a little different.
Yeah.
It's cool. You can buy both, you know, versus, you know, it's cool. But yeah, he found this at Everyday Music, just sitting in the whatever.
That's
the
crazy.
50 cent pins.
Hey.
all the time with my kids in the morning. I think this is the perfect breakfast record. It's a good record, man. It's perfect. I love Supreme by John Coltrane. It's a good record to wake up and you watch like the documentaries. He was in love with Alice, you know, like making kids with her, balled up in his good house. Made a good record. It's a classic. Yeah, my Instagram is gratitude_records. I sell records at Future Shock on 19th and Southeast Burnside. Crossroads Music on 81st and Foster, and Bar Carlo on 65th and Foster. Sell records occasionally. I do eBay auctions now, not a store. So I'll do, and it's gratitude_records as well.
Well, Tim, thanks for coming by and talking to us, man.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, grateful, man.
For an archive of Sounds Visual Radio episodes, please visit our website at soundsvisualradio.com. You can find us on Instagram at Sounds Visual Media. You can find us on Facebook at Sounds Visual PDX. Or you can email us at soundsvisualradio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.